We are ready to continue, folks, with our studies of stocks with Chapter 17 in the 4th, 5th, and 6th edition, Projecting Cash Flow and Earnings. And if you have the 3rd edition, which is still floating around out there, this is actually Chapter 7, Financial Statements and Ratio Analysis. And after Chapter 6, this is going to seem a whole lot easier. Okay? So relax. We've done some serious computations. These are going to be a whole lot easier. And these the Chapters 17 in the 4th, 5th, and 6th edition and the Chapter 7 in the 3rd edition deal mainly with financial statements and ratio analysis. It is important enough to warrant our attention, and we will look at all of the ratios, but we'll only compute a few, and we will skip the forecasting since we've already did that a little bit. We did that when we were doing the price ratio models. It's the same idea. So it's a little bit of repetition. Let's start on slide number 2. As you begin to dig deeper into a company, eventually you're going to want to take a look at their financial statements. Now, I know some of you remember nightmares from accounting, and some of you would rather not even think about accounting. And don't worry, we don't have to do any accounting. It's already done for us. That's the job of the accountants. But the more you understand what's going on in the financial statements, the better you're going to have, better idea you're going to have of what's going on with the financials of the company. And this is where the bean counters, as they're often called, do really shine. And they sometimes have a bit of a leg up on the rest of us who are not as savvy with accounting as they are. I did well in my accounting classes, but when I left the last class, I swore to myself I would never, ever do that. Do accounting again. And in the professional world, unless somebody made a very, very lucrative offer for me, and so far no one's had. So we're going to take a look at the three major financial statements, which are always included, no matter where you look on the internet, with the company that you're researching: the balance sheet, the income statement, and the cash flow statement. And in the face-to-face class, we would pass these out. We would actually have these, and we would discuss them as we go through the chapter. Now, you're going to want to go online and either print them out or have them on your screen, easy for you to access, because we're going to use them. And we use the company Walgreens. You've heard of them, right? Yeah, of course, the large pharmacy chain. The balance sheet is the financial summary of a firm's assets, liabilities, and shareholders' equity at a given point in time. What assets does the corporation own? And what liabilities do they have to pay? And what's left over after you subtract assets minus liability is called equity, or shareholders' equity. In the Business 121 course, we call it net worth. The income statement is the financial summary of the operating results of a firm covering a specified period of time, either 3 months, quarterly results, or 1 year results, annual results. And then sometimes you'll see them over several years. And then the cash flow statement is the financial summary of a firm's cash flow and other events that cause changes in the company's cash position. How, what's going on here? How is the cash flow statement different from the income statement? And this is something that the accountants would already, I understand that. And we've already made reference to this, and we'll take a look at it as we continue. So let's take a detailed look at the balance sheet. So, as I said, in the face-to-face, we would take a look at Walgreens' balance sheet. You want to take a look at it right now and see, just look, scan through the items. You'll see assets, liabilities, and then equity, what the company owns after you subtract the liabilities from the assets. And so the accountants will use the formula assets equals liabilities plus equity. And they do that for a historical reason that we don't have to go into. It's why it's called a balance sheet. The assets would be on the left-hand side, and the liabilities and the equity would be on the right-hand side, and the two must balance. But balance sheets are usually not presented that way anymore. They're presented vertically, so it's not as important. And for we mortals, we usually think assets minus liability equals equity. The accountants then break everything into current and long-term. Go away. I hate computers. I'm in the middle of a presentation. Stop telling me that the printer's turned off. Ugh, I gotta take that program off. My apologies. Where were we? Oh, yes, current versus long-term. Current means items that are going to be consumed within 1 year, and long-term are items that are going to last more than a year. In the financial planning and money management class, we usually break the time horizon into three sections. Short-term, current, up to a year or so. Intermediate term, 3, 4, 5 years. And then anything greater than 5, 7, 10 years is long-term. So take a look at the Walgreens and see some of the items. Some of them you might understand. Some of them you might be a little bit confused by, so you need to educate yourself and at least understand what these items are, because the broad categories, oh yeah, I understand that. I figured that out. The next one is the income statement. And the income statement is the difference between a company's revenues and expenses. So what's coming in, and then what's going out. And what's left over is used to pay dividends to shareholders or is kept as what are called retained earnings within the company to finance future growth. And that makes sense, right? The company makes money, revenue, sales, they go by different terms, and then they are able to pay their expenses, and if they have any left over, they have a profit. And they can take that profit and pay dividends, or they can turn around and reinvest it in the company. But here's the problem with the income statement. Some expenses are not always received or paid in cash. So that is why there is also the cash flow statement. And the cash flow statement, which is also called statement of cash flows, shows us where the money went. Because, as we discussed before, some items that are expenses, you don't write out a check to these items, to depreciation. You don't write out a check to depreciation. And yet, the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, and generally accepted accounting principles allow us to deduct depreciation from our income so that we pay fewer tax dollars, right? That's a good thing, right? Paying fewer tax dollars. But that doesn't, that what that does is it masks how much cash is really coming into the company. So whereas in the financial planning and money management class, we just have one statement, the cash flow statement, that we call the cash flow statement in the class, but it's not really the same as a statement of cash flows. In fact, it's more along the lines of the income statement. And the accountants and the personal finance class cringe and they wince and they say you guys are goofballs, but no, it serves our purposes, yes, because we don't have to worry about depreciation, right? And all the other items that go on the income statement that really aren't received as cash or aren't as paid as cash. So that's the reason we have the two here, the income statement and the cash flow statement. So the good thing to do now is to stop, pause the presentation, and take a look at the income statement and follow along, and some things might all of a sudden make sense from when you were listening to the earnings call. Remember SG&A or S&A and O expenses? They'll start to make sense when you look at the income statement. Oh, selling, general, and administrative costs. Oh, operating costs. Okay, operating expenses. Now I understand. So while the CEO and the CFO are discussing the quarterly or annual reports, the annual earnings calls, these people around the world can just download the income statement and the cash flow statement and take a look at what's going on. So notice the income statement and you'll see the top line number, which is often it's often referred to as the top line number. In other words, how much gross money came into the firm, total revenues or total sales. Then you'll see the cost of those goods sold, cost of sales, cost of goods sold, sometimes COGS. And then gross profit, and then operating expenses, operating income, and then the more expenses, and earnings before interest and taxes, and then interest, and then taxes, and all that other good stuff, and then boom, we wind up with net income. That's what we had to report as our income. But you then go to the cash flow statement, and you'll see that the cash flow statement starts where the income statement ends. It says, okay, this is what we said to the world that we earned. Well, first thing we're going to do is add back in the depreciation. Because we really didn't have any cash come out of the business. We didn't write a check to cash flow, to a depreciation. So we need to add it back in. And then there are some other things that are just subtracted and added back in to describe what's going on with the cash flow. Operating cash flow, investment cash flow, purchases and sales of fixed assets, financing cash flow, issuance or repurchase of securities and payments of dividend. See? And so we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on the cash flow statement. We're going to concentrate on the balance sheet and the income statement in the next presentation when we do a ratio analysis. So have those things at your disposal, because you're going to need them later on. And you're also, it would be nice to print out or have at your disposal the formulas for chapter 17. They're on there, the website, and they're in their book. So check them out. You'll want to have those available. Now, where do we get this information? Well, Yahoo is what I use, but you could go to any other major financial website. Or go to the library, or ask the company to send them to you. They'll send them to you if you want them to. But they might just say, why don't you just go to the internet and download them? Because they are required to send them to a system called EDGAR. And the SEC runs it and then disseminates it all around the world. And they have to do this annually, their annual report, the 10-K, and the quarterly report, the 10-Q, and we've already used that joke, so I won't use it again. Fed regulation fair disclosure. Something came about in the late 90s, and a lot of it was just because the technology made it available, easily available to do. And this regulation fair disclosure requires companies to make public disclosures of material information fairly, such that everybody at the same time now knows how much money the company made in the last quarter or the last year, and that's the earnings call, and that was part of your assignment for Chapter 5, right, was to sit in on an earnings call. Now, whether or not you sat in on at the time it was announced, at the exact same time, or just listened to it, I didn't care, that was up to you, but you see what's going on here? Before operation or regulation FD, analysts and other people who were closely associated with the company, who would knock on the company's doors before everybody would be able to get the information, were privy to information that the rest of the world didn't have. And this is not fair, right? That's why they call it fair disclosure. So they know, Starbucks is going to have a gangbuster quarter. Let's buy some shares before this information becomes public. Or, hey, somebody's not going to do so well. Let's sell the company before then. And so that is why the regulation FD was created so that everybody would get a fair shake. Everybody at the same time would know, yeah, it did great. Now, a lot of people will guess. They'll say, oh, yeah, this company's going to do really well. Or they might guess right and they might guess wrong. And there are countless other sources of information. I have heard many investors opine that nowadays there is simply too much information. It's huge. Sip from the fire hose out there. And I love this quote from a gentleman by the name of Nick Murray, who's a writer that you probably won't read his books. They're more, unless you get in the industry, they're more targeted toward people who are stockbrokers and life insurance agents and the like. But he has this great saying called wisdom sold separately. I love that saying, and it's so true. Here's all this information. Now, what do you do with it? I don't know. Yeah, right. So, let's start our discussion of financial ratios. What is a financial ratio? Well, this is review, right? We discussed that. Let's discuss some of these, and we'll review those in this first part of the presentation, and then we'll take a look at the ones we are going to be new to, or that are going to be new to us in the second part of the presentation. A financial ratio is the relation between two financial quantities expressed as the quotient of one divided by the other. Well, that's pretty straightforward. That's the definition of a ratio. And ratio analysis is the study of the relationships between financial statement accounts. And when you read The Intelligent Investor, which you're going to do, right? You're going to read The Intelligent Investor? Yes, you are. You will take note that Benjamin Graham was a big fan of ratio analysis. He used them quite often. So, hey, if Benjamin Graham did it, it's good enough for me. Recall that there is no one ratio that can accurately sum up the overall general state of a company. Each ratio must be considered in the context of all other information gathered. Plus, you must consider any ratio in the context of the industry the company exists within, and you have to look at their competitors. Right? These have to be thought of, in my opinion, as a stew, as a mix, as not just one item. Ooh! Look at that! That's it! That's the reason I'm going to buy or sell this stock. You have to look at all of them and relate them to one another. And so it becomes a mishmash, if you will, or whatever phrase you want to use. A mix, a mashup is the very popular saying now, mashup. So slide number 8. Our first set of ratios are the common stock ratios, also called the market ratios. And folks, these our review. We've already discussed these. Maybe one or two we haven't discussed, but we've already discussed most all of these. These are financial ratios that convert key information, key statistics about a firm to a per share basis. So that's why they're often called common stock ratios. And then some of these should look very familiar. PE, dividends per share, dividend yield, dividend payout ratio, book value per share, price to book, price to cash flow, price to sales, the PEG ratio, which we'll take a look at, which is really not that important. So let's take a look at these. And, of course, have your balance sheet out and your income statement. And, we won't do these calculations because they're right. You just go look them up. You just go online and bingo, they're right there. The PE, the market price divided by the earnings per share. Very simple statistic, and yet the most popular, the most talked about, the most anxiously debated statistic. Historically, as we learned in chapters 5 and 6, PE ratios were in the 5 to 12 range for mature companies, 14 to 20 range for growing companies, and greater than 20 was unusual. Today, they are all over the map. It is very commonplace to have some that have higher than 20. It is commonplace to have some growing companies with PEs very low. It just shows you how, you know, the still recovering from the effects of that huge decline in 2008 and 2009, where we all thought the world was going to end. People are still in a state of shock. Just getting over it. The P/E ratio, as we said, also tells you how long it will take in years, assuming no changes in earning, for the company to earn back its price. A P/E of 3, as we saw with Ford, will take 3 years. A P/E of 20 will take 20 years. A P/E of 1,783, whatever Facebook, is right now, whatever it is right now. Yikes. 1,800 years to earn back its price. So the higher the P/E, as we said, the more optimistic investors are about the future prospects for that company. And the lower the P/E, the more pessimistic that investors are in the aggregate, meaning the market as a whole. Does that mean they're right? Does it mean they're wrong? We'll see in 3 to 5 years, right? That's why it's the future. Slide number 10. So what we're going to do now is take a look at P/E and specific industries. So here are some companies you may have heard of: Exxon, Google, Amgen. You ever hear of Amgen? They're a very big biotechnology firm. J.P. Morgan Chase, the bank, and other financial services. General Mills, they make Cheerios, and Pfizer, which is a drug company which makes a very popular drug called Lipitor. So you look at those PEs and you go, well, what did you say Payano was average? 14, 15, 16? Well, it doesn't look like only Amgen and General Mills. Pfizer's 14.5, and what about Exxon? That doesn't look too high. And Google's 25, and J.P. Morgan is less than 10. What is going on here? Well, you can't just look at a company. You've got to look at their competitors and see what's going on in their industry. So let's add some competitors to each of one. And this is where things get a little interesting here, folks. A little interesting. Sometimes no. Very straightforward. Here we are. Look at the energy companies. They all have low PEs. Now, wait a minute. Gas is outrageously priced. Many people believe it's actually still very cheap here in the United States. Go to Europe or Japan and see how much you pay. Of course, you go to Saudi Arabia and you pay 50 cents a gallon. But are investors really excited about the future prospects for the energy companies? No, they're not that excited. Even though oil ain't going away anytime soon, dear students, and I have solar panels, we have solar panels, but still, they're a drop in the bucket. Ha ha ha, no pun. Well, actually, yes, I did. But see, investors are not that excited. So a PE of 9 for Exxon, when you look at their competitors, you go, oh, that makes sense. If you come over here to the high-tech internet companies such as Google and Yahoo, and who are Sohu and Baidu? They're the Google and the Yahoo of China and other parts of the Asian world. And you say, well, Google and Sohu are priced very optimistically by their investors. Baidu, not quite as much, but still pretty high. But then look at Yahoo. 6.99. Investors are not too excited about the prospects for Yahoo. And you might submit to me, you might say, well, Payano, Yahoo and Google really aren't competitors. And I might say, you're right. They really are two different companies, although some of their services overlap. Google is a search engine primarily, although they've got their fingers in lots of other pies. And Yahoo is more of a what we used to call a portal, in that it has news and weather, and the financial part of Yahoo, I'm sure, is very profitable for them. But some of the other parts, maybe not so. So investors are saying, I don't know. Now, does that mean to you that you should take that as a sign that you should not buy or should buy Yahoo or Google? No. To me, it's kind of like a red flag. It's kind of like a flare going up and saying, look at this! Look at this! Yahoo is demanding a much lower PE than the rest of those internet companies. And it means you need to do more digging. You need to do more research. But it's not the only thing you would use in making your decision. Does that make sense? I hope so. That's my opinion, and I'm sticking to it. And when you read Benjamin Graham or anybody else who uses ratio analysis, I believe the good ones will not say this is the only reason we're going to sell or buy this stock. They'll say, and looking at this statistic shows us this, and looking at this statistic shows us that, and overall we make a decision to buy or sell. Now Amgen and Biogen IDEC, IDEC was a company that was based here in San Diego, and they merged with Biogen, which is based in the Boston area, I think. And then Life Technologies. Well, now wait a minute. Amgen has got a 17. Biogen and Life Technologies have higher PE, so the investors are much more optimistic about their future prospects. Well, that makes sense because Amgen is a whole lot bigger than the other two, so the other two have more room to grow. But then you look at Illumina, and we're looking at almost 47.5, almost 48 PE. And what does that say to us? Well, that says something's going on here, that investors believe the future prospects for Illumina are pretty darn good. So does that mean we should buy it? Does that mean we should sell? That it means we need to do more research and see, is the story really as good as it as investors believe, or is it too good to be true and we better stay away? Because what happens? Exactly. If Peter Lynch calls it the Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner effect. The price gets bit up to the point where the coyote has run out all over the cliff, and there's nothing below him, and it takes him a while to, he looks down and he goes, oh, okay, and then he falls. And that's the way Peter Lynch says some stocks will stay at these high levels until everybody believes they're never going to fulfill on the promises that investors believe they're going to, and then the price falls. And the parachutes, as we've said, had better be very large because it's a big drop. We go and take a look at the banks, and we find that the banks are generally, except for Citigroup, let's see, J.P. Morgan 6.5, Wells Fargo almost 11, U.S. Bank, a very well-run national bank based in Minneapolis, I think, is 12, but Citigroup is 19. Well, maybe investors are saying this is a turnaround story in play. I'm just guessing. I don't really like banks, to tell you the truth. I'm not talking about investments. I'm talking about just banks. I'm a big fan of credit unions. But I've heard people say, oh, yeah, you know, they went okay for me. But I've heard far more horror stories from, not so much Wells Fargo, U.S. Bank, but definitely from Chase, Citigroup, and Bank of America takes the cake, folks. They get the most people who say, I can't believe how bad they did, how treated me. But so Citigroup is one of those that we should have a little question mark here and say, well, why is Citigroup commanding a much higher PE than the rest of them? And the same thing true over here. Look at the food companies, 17 for General Mills, 20 for Hormel. They make Spam, Kellogg's, Corn Flakes, has a higher PE, 23. So investors are a little bit more optimistic about Kellogg's future prospects than they are for the rest of them, Kraft about 18. Drug companies, same idea. Pfizer, 14.5, Eli, 15, so very close. Merck, almost 20. And then Bristol, Myers, Squibb, whoa, 32. So again, there's another one of those, look at this, like a little red flag waving up saying, look at me. It doesn't mean buy me, it means do more research about me. And maybe the story is very optimistic and good, and you want to, after doing more research, say, yeah. Or you might be saying, oh, no, this is kind of scary. Does that make sense? And so all of these ratios, you're going to want to do this. Whichever ratios you use, you're going to want to look at the ratio in the context of the industry and the competitors that the company, in the industry that the company is in and their competitors. So we're just going to do it for PE, but you would do it for the other companies and the companies that you research. Make sense? Okay, let's continue. Slide number 11. How can we account for the wide price-to-earnings disparity between different industries and different companies within industries? Well, it all gets back to the expectation of future earnings and dividend growth by investors. It's all about the future. And so here's a quote from A Random Walk Down Wall Street, which I absolutely love. And it's actually, it wasn't written by the author. It was written by Jack Dreyfuss, who was the founder of Dreyfuss Funds, one of the largest mutual fund companies out there. They're now owned by the Bank of New York, I think. Yeah. Take a nice little company that has been making shoelaces for 40 years and sells at a respectable 6x earnings ratio. Now, he wrote this in the 1960s, so it's different technology. Change the name from Shoelaces Incorporated to Electronics and Silicon Firth Burners. In today's market, the words electronics and silicon are worth 15x earnings. However, the real play comes from the word Firth Burner, which nobody understands. A word that no one understands entitles you to double your entire score. Therefore, we have 6x earnings for the shoelace business, 15x earnings for electronics and silicon, or a total of 21x earnings. Multiply this by 2 for Firth Burners, and we now have a score of 42x earnings for the new company. You see what he's saying? In other words, there's a whole lot of hype going on, folks. And if it's something that people don't even understand, then the hype gets even more crazy. And so if Jack Dreyfuss were writing this today, he would replace Firth Burners with nanotechnology or 3D printing, and he would replace electronics and silicon with social networking and China or maybe India. Exactly. It is so much often the fault of the public themselves, as Mr. Graham would say. Slide number 12, the PEG ratio. PEG? This is a very simple ratio, folks, and what it does is it compares the PE ratio to the rate of growth. So we said that the rate of growth and the PE should be roughly the same. Well, this ratio sees whether or not they are the same. You take the PE and you divide it by the growth rate. And if they're one, that means that the PE ratio matches the growth rate. That's can you understand what you're doing here? If two numbers are the same, you divide them by one another, you wind up with one. So a PEG ratio of 1 was what we were expecting, and that was desirable since it meant that the PE ratio equaled the growth rate. Anything above 1 was considered high. But greater than 1 is common these days, and less than 1 is not unheard of. So it's something to take a look at, but realize it's mostly just telling you that which you already have looked at. You've already seen, their PE is 20 and they're growing at 25. That's a good sign. Or the PE is 20 and they're only growing at 5%. I don't know if I'm too interested in this company. So the PEG ratio puts that into a number format. Slide number 13, dividends per share. Now, this is a review. How much of the dividends each share of stock will receive? And you don't have to compute it. It's already done for you. They take the annual dividends and divide it by a number of shares. And as we discussed, dividends became taboo or fuddy-duddy and passé during the 1990s. And since the 2000 to 2002 bear market, investors have changed their minds about dividends. And certainly since 2008, well, they're still in shock. Dividends can be discussed in polite company again. And then the dividend yield. Very important statistic because it's a measure of how much dividends are as a percentage of the stock price. So it's a very simple calculation. And again, you saw in Chapter 5 that it's already there. You just look it up. You take the dividends per share and divide it by the market price. And reviewing, we find that this important statistic allows an investor to compare a company to other forms of investment that pay income, such as savings accounts or bonds. So it allows us to treat our stock as a investment that pays an income to us. And as we said, 4, 5, 6% was considered good, but then dividends fell at the bubble, the height of the stock bubble in 2000, March 2000, they fell to 1%. And that's the S&P 500. Remember, some of them were paying higher, some weren't paying any. It's currently about 2.2%. Well, hey, you know, the Treasury bonds are yielding about 2%. I think they just went above 2%, didn't they? I don't remember. And savings accounts are yielding far less than 1%. And some stocks are paying much more than that, and I hope you saw a few, while many others are paying no dividends at all. So, very interesting. So, do we like dividends? Yes, we do. We love dividends because all the other numbers you look at on that cash flow statement, on that income statement, on that balance sheet, you don't really know whether or not they're real. I mean, you trust many of the companies that you deal with, right? Well, some of them were downright lying, such as Enron. But the one statistic you know is the truth is the dividend. And why do you know it's the truth? Because you got the money in your pocket. Well, they electronically sent it to your account, and some people still get it as checks, but very few. So, yeah, we love dividends. Slide number 15. The dividend payout ratio is a measure of how much of a company's earnings are being paid out to shareholders in the form of dividends. And again, this is review. We take the dividends per share and we divide it by the earnings per share. And in general, more mature companies often pay out much or almost all of their earnings in the form of dividends. Why? Because they don't need them. They don't need them to reinvest back in the company. Whereas growing companies retain their earnings, called retained earnings, to support the growth of the company. Make sense? So we should expect defensive, mature, and blue chip and income companies to be paying out a much higher payout ratio, and growing companies, tech companies, and newer companies to be paying out a lower ratio. Slide number 16, book value per share. Now, some of you had a hard time finding this in Chapter 5. I told you where it was in the key statistics section. It's a measure of the net worth of a company on a per share basis. So you take what the company owns, the shareholder's equity, and divide it by the number of shares outstanding. And you don't have to do that because it's already done for you. You just look it up. Book value per share tells an investor how much assets are behind each share of stock. In other words, if all the assets of the company were liquidated, and then the debts were, of course, the liabilities were paid off, how much would each shareholder receive? And it is common for the actual market price of a share to be above the book value per share, since the company is worth more intact than if it were dissolved. You understand? Sure, I mean, intuitively you know that. And we gave the analogy of a pizza shop or a shoe shop. If you sold all the assets, paid off all the debts, you wouldn't have much left. The company is worth far more intact than if it were destroyed and liquidated. But that's not always the case. And there are some companies, usually very older companies, where their technology has become obsolete or whatever, and the company is sometimes worth more broken up and sold off into pieces. Today, it is common for the market price to be far above the book value. So let's now take a look at price to book value per share, and we discuss this, and we take the, it's very simple. You take the market price and you divide it by book value per share. So remember, price to earnings, exactly, price to cash flow, all these other ones we did. Price to book value, given the book value per share, given that the book value per share is often less than the market price, the price to book value per share tells an investor how far above the book value the market value is. So read that carefully in case I said it too quickly. If the price to book value per share is equal to 1, that means the market price and the book value are the same. So it's common to see a price-to-book value of 3 or 4, meaning that the price is 3 times more or 4 times more what the book value is, what the company could be sold for if you liquidated all the assets, paid off all the debts. I've seen some companies these days where the price to book value per share is in the 1.4, 1.5 range. So there are some companies out there that are selling close and during close to their book price to book value per share, and of one where the two are equal. And then during the crisis, many companies were selling for less than their book value per share. Their market price was less than the book value per share. And many of the companies were based in Japan. I mean, well, these are companies that, you know, these are Sony, Toyota, Honda, Panasonic, Bridgestone. These are big companies. And for that reason, many people have said the Japanese stock market is way undervalued. And we've seen just recently the Japanese stock market start to respond favorably. So we'll see what happens in the future. Slide number 18. Price to cash flow ratio. Again, we've already seen this. It's the current price divided by the current cash flow per share. And as we've discussed, cash flow often differs from earnings per share for several reasons, but the most common reason is depreciation is not an actual cash expenditure. But there are many reasons that cash flow and earnings differ. And you will hear analysts talk about good quality versus poor quality earnings. Sure, they're making a whole lot of money, but their cash is going down. Current price divided by cash flow per share. And during the internet mania, many companies are reporting record earnings. At the same time, their cash flow is negative. How could that be? Right, they were selling things, and then they were telling, don't worry, don't give us the cash yet, pay us back over the next 10, 20 years. And then those companies went out of business. And our last review ratio is the price to sales. The current price divided by the sales as opposed to the earnings or as opposed to the cash flow. And historically, a higher price to sales ratio suggested a higher sales growth. And a lower price to sales ratio suggested a lower sales growth. So you take the current price divided by the annual sales. And as we discussed in Chapter 6, during the internet mania, many analysts use price to sales instead of price to earnings. Since most all of the new companies never generated any earnings and probably never were going to generate any earnings for several years to come, and they didn't get that long before they went poof. So, that is our introduction and discussion and review of financial ratios, and specifically the common stock or market ratios. When we return, we will take a look at the ones that we haven't seen yet, the profitability, liquidity, activity, and leverage ratios. And so make sure you have your calculator handy, make sure you have those your formula sheet ready, and the balance sheet and the income statement. And we'll see you in our next presentation for this chapter.